Hey, this is Randy Gage, and you're listening to the Power Prosperity Podcast.
Hello, welcome to the Long Shot Leaders Podcast. I'm Michael Stein. My guest today is Randy Gage. Randy is a super high-performing entrepreneur, an author of 14 books, and a motivational speaker. Randy was raised by his mother after being charged with armed robbery at age 15 to fund a drug deal. He served time in juvenile hall, and he moved to Miami, Florida, where he worked as a dishwasher, and he worked his way up, minimum wage at a pancake house, and then by the age 16, he became manager. At age 20, he started doing network marketing with Amway. That's not an easy gig. He did really well with network marketing, and then he decided to open up pizza restaurants. He failed miserably and went into debt, but he bounced back and found financial success again. And that kept on climbing. But that wasn't the end of his challenges. He actually ended up being shot a few years after that, but survived. It's a great up and down story. He is very interesting, smart, unique guy. Here is Randy Gage. All right, Randy Gage, so excited to talk to you today. You know, as we're talking in the pregame, you know, you have quite the perfect arc for your story. We tell stories about people's lives and gives us an inclination of how someone, you know, became successful, right? And yours just kind of fits right in there real easily. So we're going to hit the ground running. You know, first of all, where were you born? Where'd you grow up?
Well, we have to say I have the perfect arc if you believe in storytelling the way Stephen Pressfield writes books.
Yeah.
You know, and he says, you get your hero on the ground, and there you beat them to an inch of their life. And then just when they start to crawl up, then a meteorite lands on them. And then when they survive that, then they get, you know, spinal meningitis and their legs are cut off by a train. And only when they reach the final all hope is lost moment.
Right, right. Now you have that, but you didn't get the legs chopped off in the spinal meningitis. But you have something that fits that category.
Yeah, that's why I say that analogy only works if we're doing it with the full on drama trauma.
Right, right. Well, you know, this will be somewhere between that and maybe Nomadland, where the arc is a little more vague, right? You know, but still somewhat of an arc. Mm-hmm. But you weren't homeless. Were you in Florida at that time when, you know, growing up? Were you born?
No, I actually grew up in Madison, Wisconsin. Oh. And until I was in jail for armed robbery at 15. And
Where were you born? You were born in Madison?
Madison.
What did mom and dad do?
Okay, dad, I never met, never saw. My mother raised three kids by herself, knocking on doors, selling Avon products.
Avon products. That's going to come into our story a little bit later, because that's kind of like somewhat, you know. So now when you were like 9 or 10 years old, I asked this question, but it so pertains to you. What was one of your emotional wants? Not a material want, but like, did you find yourself like emotionally always wanting something? I mean, it was a dad or like a connection, or what do you think an emotional want was?
Yeah, I think at 9 or 10, my greatest emotional want was to be accepted, to be normal. I was this pathologically shy kid, bookworm in my room, just reading all the time, listening to the radio, calling in, talking to the DJs. Had an older brother, 3 years older, and he was this outgoing, you know, sports playing regular guy. And so I just didn't even relate to him very well. You know, it was because I was just so shy and just had so many emotional needs that weren't being met. You know, I like to joke that my family, we put the fun back in dysfunctional, you know.
Yeah, I hear that sometimes. Was it just you and your brother?
I know I had a younger sister, 3 years younger.
You were the middle one.
Yeah.
A problem child. The middle ones, they always say that, you know, not the one, that's a cliche.
And I don't have any evidence to dispute that.
So let's get into high school, you know? So you're getting into high school. Where you, what was that like for you? Were you a good student? What was that like?
I was a horrible student. I was teenage alcoholic, teenage drug addict. So I wasn't going to school. I was skipping for weeks at a time. And that kind of culminated when I went to jail. I was going to, I guess, junior high is what we called it then, or middle school. It was Cherokee Middle School. And then Madison West Senior High. So I went to senior high like maybe part of 1 year. Then I was in jail and they expelled me and just said, okay, we don't want you back. Just come out, you know, don't come back.
Let's go to that, because that's the big crossroads of your life at that time, right? You know, that's the first bigger one. I'm sure there's many, but that's got to be a huge crossroad. Did that shift you one way or another? What was that when that happened? What was going on in your mind?
Yeah, it really was a seminal moment, because sitting in jail for months, you do have a little opportunity to rethink your life and rethink the choices you've made up to that point. I was so blessed. My best buddy was a guy named David. He dated a girl named Joy, and her father was a teacher in the school system. And she went home and said, "Dad, you have to go rescue Randy Gage. He's in jail. He needs help." And so just one day, I heard jangling of keys, and then the cell door opened and this guy came in, and it was her father. His name was Baxter Richardson. And he came in to rescue me and told me, "You don't belong here. You're capable of great things." And of course I thought, who is this clown? What is he? He obviously has no idea who he's talking to. And I told him that. "No, you're so far off base, you have no idea." And he said, "That's not true. I talked to your teachers. I pulled your transcripts. They your teachers tell me you skip school for 3 weeks at a time, and then you come in and you ace a test. Your reading comprehension level is beyond college. You could do great things." And, that was my saving grace, I think, as a kid, is I loved to read. So that helped me develop my thinking and my intellect, because I sure wasn't getting it from school. I wasn't being challenged at school. It was just a joke to me. But I so desperately wanted to believe him when he said that I could be capable of great things that I believed him. Because what was the other alternative, you know? And because he believed in me, I started to believe in me.
Yes.
And then, I had a public defender attorney who believed in me. I had a judge who said, "Hey, let's give this kid another shot. See if he can turn his life around."
How old were you?
Yeah, that really was a seminal turning point for me.
At that time, how old were you?
16.
16 years old. So you go back to high school after that.
I went back for a short time. Baxter was just transitioning. They were doing an experimental school in Madison. They called it the School Without Walls. So they had a campus, but the idea was if you wanted to study electricity or be an electrician, you would go and apprentice with an electrician or a plumber or whatever. And students could teach classes, right? So if you created a curriculum and you got a teacher to be your advisor, you could teach a class. So I taught a class on political science because I was fascinated with politics, always have been, still am. And I did that for, 6 months or so I was in there. But then I had moved out of the house and I lived by myself and I needed to make more money.
Where were you working at that time? What were you doing for money at that time?
I was, working restaurant jobs, cook, dishwasher, that kind of stuff. Making it work. And okay. So I thought, I gotta quit school and make more money. And if I work really hard, I will become a restaurant manager. And this is the ultimate pinnacle of success I could possibly imagine.
Right. Okay. So you look for another job. What'd you get into?
I stayed in restaurants and I became a manager trainee, and then I became an assistant manager, and then I became a manager.
You hit your goal. What held you at that point?
Well, truthfully, I was 17 years old when I was managing a restaurant.
Yeah.
Because I had lied about my age to get a waiter job at Red Lobster. They came to town. They were opening a new store and they served beer and wine. And you had to be 18 years old to serve. So I always like could grow a mustache when I was young. So I looked older. And so I told them I was 20 and they hired me. And then while I was working for them, I was also working the graveyard shift of flipping burgers and eggs at Howard Johnson's. And they made me a manager trainee and then an assistant manager. And then they fired the manager of the Milwaukee store. And they said, hey, we want you to be the interim manager of the Layton Avenue, Howard Johnson. So I went in and I was like, I will do such a good job. They're going to make me the permanent manager. And I did. Yeah. So I was 17 and I was running a restaurant doing the P&L and, you know, all that stuff at 17 years old.
Great. So how long that last?
Till I was like 20, I think, I realized, okay, I have made my dream. I wear a tie. I have a really impressive ring of keys. I can walk around with the coffee pot. Hi, how's your dinner this evening? Anything, you know? So I had made it and I was still broke. And I realized my waiters and waitresses, they make more money than I do. I'm working 80, 90 hours a week. I'm on a straight salary. I was probably making, you know, $350 a week or some amount. And I had waiters and waitresses making $500 or $600, right?
Right.
And I said, I need to open my own restaurant. That's the real American dream.
Right.
So I did that with a buddy of mine who actually had been my assistant manager. We went and we leased a restaurant and a seafood place. And it was a disaster because we didn't have enough money to really do it. But, you know, I made a go for it.
Yeah. So then that's your, you know, that's a big failure at that point, you know.
Huge.
That's okay.
Biggest failure. I mean, I was just like, I didn't even know what to do. I mean, I was so humiliated, so embarrassed. I had told all my friends I was an entrepreneur now, and then I had to go back and get a job again and try to make money. And a similar thing happened when I was 30. I what happened along the way, I got introduced to direct selling or leverage sales, right?
Well, and let's get into that time because that's you know, network marketing. It's such such an interesting niche, so difficult, has a stigma to it. That was with Amway, right?
Amway's the first company I joined when I was 20. I got sponsored into Amway.
And Amway had such a, you know, still when people, you know, there's still, you know, comedians will joke about Amway, right? So like, let's get into that because that's tough sales. That is Amway specialized in all kinds of psychology and, you know, to be an Amway salesman, there's a lot of dynamics. So that those are the trenches, I think. I've talked to Amway salesmen before. It's very fascinating. So what was that time like? You excelled at that, right?
I didn't make any money with Amway. I was with them like 6 months and I quit because I wasn't a millionaire yet. They seem to have done pretty well without me since they're doing like $10 billion a year or whatever they're doing.
Right.
So I guess they survived the loss of me. And I just bounced around for like 5 years trying to find a different, you know, I got a deal just like Amway, only better. And then quit that, drop out. Hey, I got a deal just like the deal that was better than Amway, only it's better than the deal that was better than Amway. And so 5 years, I just bounced around, quitting, trying new companies, trying to work 10 companies at the same time. And then finally kind of had to have a come to Jesus meeting with myself and say, okay, one of two things is true. Either this network marketing is all bullshit, or network marketing actually works and the problem is me.
Right.
But it's not working. You know, something doesn't compute here. So either this is just a scam and all these people who say they're driving these bonus cars and going on these cruises and winning these contests and walking, you know, flashing those big, you know, 10-foot wide bonus checks they get on stage, you know, from the president of the company. That's all a mirage. It's all bullshit. You can't, you know, it's all Hollywood scripted or something. Or the business actually works and I've never learned how to do it the right way. And so that really was the next big transformational moment. And this, and that's, by the way, why, how I earned the money to open this second restaurant was making some money in direct sales as a side business while I was still working in the as the restaurant business. And
you mastered the network marketing, you know, hurdle.
I did. I really learned how, you know, I've made millions and millions of dollars in that business, in bonus checks.
If you could rattle off maybe like two or three bullet points on really what was the big difference maker, really what helps to be successful in that. I've always fascinated. My friend did it. He was really successful at it. I always wondered, how do those guys, you know, because it never clicked with me, you know, how do those guys succeed in doing, what are the key points?
The key is duplication. You got to say, okay, how can I do this business in a way that the people I bring into it are going to be able to reproduce the same results? And I had thought, okay, so I just, you know, the first people I was, you know, they weren't doing anything. And I thought, well, they're just stupid people. I need more people. They're lazy people. I need more people. So I'm going to get good at presenting. Because those days, that's how you built the business. You drew the circles on a whiteboard or a chalkboard and then later with slides. But, you know, it was showing the plan, drawing the circles. So I got my Miami Vice suit. I found a restaurant up in Sunny Isles that had like a banquet room in the back. And they said I could use it every weeknight. As long as they didn't have it booked, I could use it for free. As long as the people came, they could, you know, buy a coffee or tea or a piece of pie or something. So I started doing meetings 5 nights a week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And I sponsored like 30 people in a month. And I think, you know, you can do the math. 30 people, they each get five. That's going to be 150. They each get five. That's going to be, and they each get five. So I'm like, all right, I can order my Lamborghini now.
And you vetted out the right people, which, you know, leverage your time the proper way. That was the key. Also, you learned on, look, this is not a quantity thing. I got to try to vet out the proper people for quality.
Well, what happened was, of course, the 30 people didn't turn into 150 people. They turned into 3 people because 27 dropped out. Yeah. So I'm like, okay, so those 27 people, those were the stupid, ignorant, lazy people. I can replace them because I know how to draw circles. So I did. I replaced them all the next month. And of course, 25 of them dropped out. I'm like, okay, wait a minute. And that's when this kind of 5-year window came up, and I had that little reevaluation to say, okay, what I'm doing can't be duplicated. I've got to create a system, and I've got to create tools that my people can use because they can't replicate me up on a stage. Right. The average person who joins the business. I've got to find a flip chart, an audio, a video, brochure, whatever, something else that conveys, here's what this business is about. Here's how you can be successful with it. Here's what it takes. And that's when I really started to turn it around.
Interesting. Okay. So you excel at that. That does well. And then you segued into, did you say a restaurant again?
Yeah. I
you got the disease. You got the restaurant disease.
Escape the restaurant business, right?
Right.
I'm making $10,000 a month in network marketing, which I'm the wealthiest person I have ever met in my life when I'm making $10,000 a month, right? I mean, this is like, you know, I viewed that the way people look at Elon Musk today. That's how I viewed making 10 grand a month back in the day. And so I thought, oh, but, you know, every time I'd see an empty restaurant, I'm like, man, with all I know now, So I just had a buddy with a pizza place. And then there was another one, pizza place went out of business in North Miami. And he said, hey, what about if we go in and partners and, you know, open up that store and we'll make it the second location. But again, we didn't really have the money it takes. Restaurants are very capital intensive businesses. And so I leave direct selling, which is making me money, because once I open the restaurant, now I'm back to 80, 90 hours a week, because that's what the restaurant business is, right? You work 7 days a week. Your day off is, hey, if everybody shows up and you don't have to take anyone else's shift, then you could just do the schedule and the orders, and maybe you can go home after 4 hours. That's your day.
Right. 24/7, really, yeah.
Oh, God. So I get, you know, sucked into that time-sucking vortex black hole. And then I lose, you know, I stop doing my direct selling business. And eventually the IRS comes and seizes our restaurant because we haven't paid the taxes. And they auction it off for the debt. So I'm $55,000 in debt. No house, no car, no job, no credit cards. And I'm eventually selling off my furniture, sleeping on the floor.
How old are you at this point?
I was like 30, 30, 31, 32, something like that.
Okay. So this is our dark night of the soul right here, isn't it? Yeah. You know, because you're a writer. We're using the, ladies and gentlemen, we're using writing references today because Randy's such a prolific writer. So this is, I'm sure there actually is in your story I read, there's something else coming up, but there's another dark night of the soul, but this is like another, you know, first big, another inciting incident that's really dark.
Yeah.
This moment.
And I'm so humiliated at this point. I remember, so I had a pickup truck, which we used for deliveries, which was leased in the business. So when the IRS seized the business, I lost that. So I didn't even have a car. So I remember being able to borrow a car from a friend and driving up I-95, just with nowhere to go, just driving, tears streaming down my face, thinking, how am I going to tell my mother and my family what happened? You know, what are my friends going to say? And I had like so much psychic damage that I just, you know, I ended up going and taking a job in South Miami where I didn't know anybody. There was a dinette in a drugstore that needed a breakfast cook. So I went and became a breakfast cook, getting up at 4:30 in the morning and getting there at 5:30 and getting the place ready to open and everything. And did that for a while to, you know, just get myself, you know, back to where I could pay the rent and buy groceries and, you know, do all of that stuff.
This is your gather your forces moment. We just interviewed Robert Greene, the author of 48 Laws of Power, you know, and this is the moment where he talks about one of the laws of power is, you know, when you lose that battle, sometimes you just have to gather your forces and, you know, just take a step back and then get your strength again. So that you built up a little bit of scratch, you know, a little bit of, you know, got your equilibrium straight. Then where did you go from there?
I said, I got to go back in direct selling because what am I going to do? Denny's would hire me as a manager or Fridays or someplace like that. They're going to pay me. Because remember, this is still 30 years ago. I'm an old guy, right? So this is like 30 years ago. So maybe.
You look great now.
thanks.
Look young.
Maybe a restaurant manager made 30 grand a year, 35 grand a year or something like that. Well, I got $55,000 in debt. And the clock with the IRS, when that's ticking, there's late payments, interest. Believe me, it's cheaper to borrow money from the mob than it is to owe money to the IRS. Right. So I'm like, if I get a job at Denny's or something, I mean, I'll be working the rest of my life and still be in debt. So I got to go back into direct selling. I got to make some big money rapidly because that's the only way I'm going to get out of debt. So that's what I did.
And how long did you do that for?
Till now.
Now? Oh, you still do it. You still do the network marketing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not active. I still have a position with a company, the last company I worked with, and I, you know, get residual income from.
So you just really blew it up. You blew it up from there after, you know, that after Tour de France, of all the shit you went through, you said, now I'm really going to exploit this.
Because it's
stayed focused.
By this point, I learned the most, you know, the superpower for creating wealth is leverage. Everybody who has become ultra wealthy, ultra successful, they all practice leverage in some way or another.
Right. Right. So your first book, when did you write that?
I think probably 96, because I was, I became a speaker because I had started this training for my own team, you know, how to be successful in the business. And then people from other lines started saying, hey, can we sit in? We hear you do this training on one Saturday every month. Can we? And I'm like, yeah, you know, give me $5 for the meeting room and the donuts and you can sit in. And then people started flying in from California, from New York. And then people started saying, well, we have a team in Chicago. You know, what would you charge if we paid your plane ticket and your hotel? How much would we have to pay you to come and do this training for our group up there? And so I kind of became the unofficial trainer for that company. And then the company got in a lawsuit. Discovery came out. It was a total made up story. They had this really sexy story about the company that really romanticized everything. So anyway, the founder of the company, his sisters go and start a competing company and they sue each other and it goes to a lawsuit. And then the lawsuit, they start deposing them and getting them to testify. And I realized this company I'm working with is, it's just all made up. There's no, this isn't true. This guy's a fraud.
Yeah,
he had been making himself up as, you know, like an herbal doctor who had studied from since the, you know, Boxer Rebellion. These secret fam recipes have been passed along the generations of his family. And he studied at the knee of his grandfather, who was a great herbal master. And then the lawsuit, somebody sends me the transcripts. And yeah, I forget what the grandfather was. He didn't. He was supposed to be this, you know, herbal doc. He like sold timeshare swimming pools or some crap. I mean, it was just total fabrication. I'm like, oh my God, I can't build in this one more minute. This is my name. This is my reputation. Because when you're in direct selling, you're selling your name. This is totally your reputation, right? You got to pick what you're working with and who you're working with and all of that. So, you know, to date myself, I typed out a resignation letter and overnighted it to them to resign. Right. And I just said, hey, you know, if I was training all these groups in my company, I could train groups in other companies and I'll just be a trainer. And I'll rent.
This is what got you to segue into writing, though, because you wanted to be able to offer a book. When you do these meetings, you got to, people always say, well, can you give a book to like our clients?
Everybody says, you got to write a book. Do you have a book with all your stuff? So I'm hearing this and I'm like, so I think it was in 96, I wrote a book called How to Build a Multi-Level Money Machine.
Nice.
And that book has... It went through 5 or 6 editions, 20 or 25 printings, 20 some languages, more than 2 million copies around the world. I mean, huge in Russia, in Malaysia, in Indonesia, in Korea, in Germany, and everywhere.
Awesome. But you've written 14 books.
Yeah.
But there's a title. Now, you know when a writer gets really comfortable and when somebody really knows what they're doing, when they title their book, and I can't memorize it, and I haven't written it down, it's a long title. And do you have a, what's the longest title of your book? This has to be the longest title. Can you share that long title book?
I think it's probably that one, How to Build a Multi-Level Money Machine. Or, see, I believe in,
there's another title though, real quick. Let's rattle off some of the titles of your book.
Mad Genius. Risky is the New Safe, a prosperity mind, accept your abundance, direct selling success. You might be thinking of the title and the subtitle.
Yeah, so let's talk about the crazy subtitle.
Okay. So finally, after all those editions of the book, you know, the publishers are saying, hey, we need one more new edition because stuff has changed. And I'm like, you know what? That book, I got to retire that book. It's just the business has changed so much. The regulatory environment, everything's in the cell phone now. Everything's on social media now. Right. I'm just going to get a blank canvas. And so I wrote a book called Direct Selling Success. And then instead, the subtitle was, instead of From A to Z, it was From Amway to Zombies.
That's not the one that I was thinking, but that's great too.
Okay, well, that was...
You got great bylines then. That's what you do.
Yeah, and that, because, you know, I feel like the thing I'm talking about in the book is these zombies who just keep running from deal to next deal. They're always looking for the next hot deal. They're like zombies. They just want to eat your brain, right? So instead of From A to Z, I said From Amway to Zombie. And then we put where's the copy of it?
He's getting up to get these books. And he's written 14, folks.
Yeah, so
and now this one is
we put a zombie where the eye is. And we knew that, you know, this is going to get attention. It's going to get publicity. Right. It's going to create some
old letters.
Yeah. And so this is the fastest selling book my publisher in Iran has ever put out. Wow. It broke the record in Germany. We just sold the Algerian rights, I think, the other day.
That's wild.
Yeah, a lot of language. So that's doing really well.
So you're really good at writing business books. Right. Now, let's just rattle off a couple bullet points right off here. It'd be silly not to, like, you know, tell our audience, like, what are, you know, two or three really good bullet points for writing a great business book?
Write in eighth grade, everyday, conversational language. Mm-hmm. Don't try to sound like a business book. This is true for all writing, but especially true for books. If you want a book to have an impact on somebody, write it the same way you would tell it to them over coffee at Starbucks.
Nice.
Tell stories. You know, I learned Bill Gove was like my mentor when I first started speaking. He was the first president of the National Speakers Association. I said, Randy, if you go, somebody does a seminar and they say 27 tips to success, everybody will like it. And then, but if you talk to someone in the room afterward and say, oh, really, what were they? Nobody could tell you what they are. He said, what you got to do is tell stories that make point for the audience. So tell a story, make a point. Tell a story. So like this book. In my last book is called Radical Rebirth. That's for everybody who listens to Long Shot Leaders podcast. You have to read Radical Rebirth because you're going to say, oh my God, he wrote that book just for me.
Oh, that's good when that happens.
But if you want to, you know, if you analyze it, you say however many, let's say it's 12 chapters, whatever they are, you're going to say, wow, isn't that fascinating? Each chapter starts with a story.
Yes.
A story from Randy's life, right? Because what makes a great book is, you know, and I actually do I have a author apprentice program that I do once a year where I actually work with people for like a 9-month period to have them write a business, you know, a nonfiction book. And the first thing I'm telling them is this has to be the book that nobody else in the world can write.
Right.
See, when I write a book, just like this podcast, this interview you're doing with me, right? No one in the world can rip off my podcast unless they have, you know, they worked in Amway, they had their business seized by the IRS, they sold their furniture, they slept, right? So I tell those stories. So the people who are listening, they say, oh, this isn't some rich guy who's never been when I am giving me some ridiculous advice he read in a book.
Right.
They're saying, this guy has been where I am. He's qualified to teach me because he was where I was and he got to where I want to be. Hopefully that's the goal, right?
Got it.
So same thing in a book. You've got to tell the stories that have a lesson for the reader so they could apply them in their life and say, oh yeah, that worked for him or that worked for her. That could work for me.
Got it. Okay. So as, before we go on, we'll just bullet point. So keep it simple, keep it simple. Keep it super simple.
Eighth grade level.
Yeah. Conversational. And then tell a story and then have your points afterwards.
Yeah.
Those are your big three. Now, real quick, in 2000, you moved out of Florida to San Diego.
Actually, I went on a sabbatical. And I think
because I'm getting at this, why'd you leave Florida?
I did for a while when I did the sabbatical. What happened is, okay, let me try to make a really long story halfway long.
Yeah.
I was at a reflection point in my life. I had made a lot of money. I experimented with a lot of drugs, faced addiction again, was kind of reevaluating my life. And I had, made a fortune and I had lots of possessions. And I was going in my closet to look for a different color baseball hat because I had joined a different softball team and they had different colors. Right. I'm moving some hats and I'm like, oh my God, look at these watches. And I had a, what's the name of that brand? A couple of really expensive watches that I had bought and never worn. And I had been doing some renovation in my condo and there were workers there. So I remember I had put them behind this cabin. It's like, I don't want to just tempt anybody with, leave out a, $100,000 watch. Maybe they're going to, do something stupid. So I forgot I had even bought them because I put them and I'd never worn them, but I put them behind these hands because I'm a watch whore, right? I had like 300 watches. So, and I find those and I say, do I own this stuff or does this stuff own me? I've got five cars downstairs. I have a guy who comes every week to detail and they're all gorgeous, exotic sports cars, and I have a guy who comes every week to detail. And half the time he comes and three of them I didn't even drive that week. And I would say, if I just, because I was so poor for so long that once I started to get money, I'm like, okay, I got fuck you money. So I'm going to show I got fuck you money.
Right.
So I'm saying this isn't really doing it for me. This is not really prosperous living to me. So I'm thinking about that. And that day I get a letter in the mailbox from a real estate agent who's says, hey, I have a client. They're willing to pay all cash. They're looking for a unit in your building, in your line. My line was the one that had 3-bedroom, 3-bath.
Yeah.
So they wanted this line, high floor. And I just thought, so I called my buddy Billy, who's a real estate agent. I said, call up this guy and tell him this price. I quoted a really crazy price and tell him if he wants to pay that price, I'll sell. And I told myself, if he buys it, then I'm just going to go on a sabbatical. I'm going to shut down all my social media. I'm going to stop working the business. I'm just going to travel the world. I'm going to study the great issues of the history and work on myself. And, there's some funny little twists in the road that happened. Well, we don't have time for all that. The end of the result, it was the sheikh from Dubai. He paid what I asked for and more, probably from the sofa cushions, the chain, change he took out of the sofa cushions. And so I sold that place in Miami and I had a place already in Sydney. So I went to Sydney in the meantime. I stopped on the way in San Diego because I always wanted to live there. So I spent a day or two with a real estate agent there looking at places. Then I went to Sydney, and then I traveled like around the world a lot. And the building I liked in San Diego, a unit came available, so I bought that. And then I really missed Miami, so I came back and I bought a place in Miami again. So, and then I just kind of went different places.
Nice. I don't know what it was, but I thought that I heard that you got a gun pulled on you in a Miami or something, and that's why you moved to San Diego. I don't know. I was reading something like that, but I'm not sure.
I did get shot in an armed
robbery. You might want to. You're so nonchalant about that. Oh yeah, by the way, I got shot. Well, real quick, just
move out of Miami or anything. That was back in the cocaine cowboy days of Miami. There was a hopped up crackhead who wanted to. I came home, you know, from a club late in the middle of the night. And it was hopped up crackhead, and he shot me and left me for
dead. Where'd you get shot?
In the abdomen.
In the abdomen.
Yeah.
Right on the side. They're not in the middle, right? Off to the side.
Yeah. Side. Right in and the large. It's actually.
And you think that's it, right? You think, oh shit, this is how I'm going to die.
Yeah. I mean, I it's funny. I just, before we got on, I was doing a speech for a company in London, and I was telling that story. That's kind of one of my signature stories, right? That people want to hear.
The I got shot story?
Yeah.
And, that's a big one.
So I was just talking about this, you know, an hour ago. But yeah, it's like 3 a.m. and gunshots are so loud. It's not like on TV. There's a reason why you wear earmuffs when you're at a shooting range, right? It's so loud. And so I'm laying in the street, a pool of blood. I'm kind of like under a street light, and I see this blood going, and I'm thinking, man, lights are going to be coming on. People are going to be coming out to save me. And nobody shows up. No lights.
Oh my God.
I'm like, I can't believe it. And I realize if I don't get up out of this street, I'm going to die here.
Yeah.
So I've got a pullover shirt. I rip it off and I tie it up around my, you know, abdomen the best I can to stop the blood. And I go across, you know, up to the apartment where I live and go up a flight of stairs and collapse into a chair and call 911 and get an ambulance.
Oh my God. Wow. And then they were you surprised that you lived?
Oh, this was really the point of this speech I was doing that I just did was on belief, because it was pretty touch and go. They had to put that spacesuit on me in the ambulance, because when you lose so much blood, your heart stops pumping. So they put on like a pressure suit to keep your heart pumping. So I was really touch and go, right? So it's 3 a.m. They're in the emergency room, you know, and they say, you know, who's your next of kin? And I say, that's my mother in Wisconsin. And they say, okay, give us her number. And I'm like, no, you can't call her. She'll be hysterical. You know, like, you don't understand. You may not make it through this surgery. And I was like, no, I'll make it. Get your surgery done. And when we're done, I'll give you my mom's number. And but I don't want anyone calling her, waking her up at 3-4 a.m. and getting her hysterical.
Yeah.
So they're like, you're not hearing us. You probably won't make. So they get like, they got 6 or 8 doctors all surrounding me, telling me I'm not going to make this surgery. And I'm like, I will make it. You just do whatever you got to do, but I'm going to make it.
Good for you.
I had a belief in my future at that point. And so I couldn't die because I had that belief that I had a future.
That's right. That's great. So where, dare I say, what do you have planned right now, your next 3 to 5?
I kind of segued. I now think of myself, I used to be a speaker who wrote. Now I would probably my last midlife crisis I had a few years ago, my most recent one was I said, no, I'm a writer who speaks. When I'm happiest, I'm hunched over my MacBook Pro in my lonely writer's garret, typing out my next book. And so really, I want to write a book every year. for the rest of my life. And that's, you know, people still want to hire me for speeches. I'll do the ones that pick and choose the ones that would really be fun and places I want to go. And the money is good and it's worth the trip. And, you know, but really, I feel like at my essence, I'm a writer. And that's the gift that I need to be exploring with myself.
Well, you've written 14. You're great at it. And I can't see a reason why you wouldn't want to just do that forever. That's awesome. Tell people where they can, you know, go find you, your books and everything else.
All right. So don't look for me on social media. I shut down all of my accounts. I'm not on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, nothing.
When did you do that? When did you shut everything down?
Maybe 4 months ago.
Liberating. So then how do people find you? So just go to Amazon and look for your book?
It's randygage.com. That's kind of my Starfleet command site. And there's a link to my podcast there. There's a link to my blog there and a link to my YouTube channel there. So that's the,
there you go.
You know, and then, you know, books, you know, 95% of all the books are bought on Amazon anyway. So that's probably the best place to. And I'm telling you, if you're listening to this podcast, Radical Rebirth, subtitle of that is Killing Off the Old You. You know, how to kill off yourself, how to recreate yourself. And I just think you being who you are, the topics that you talk about on this, the kind of guests you have, I think the people who listen to this podcast, that Radical Rebirth book will be just what the doctor ordered.
Awesome. Randy Gage. I mean, look, everybody look it up. Radical Rebirth. You know, he's written, I mean, it is brutal to write one book. The fact that you know, he has written 14, I mean, my hat's off to you, and you're going to continue to do more. So it's just amazing. Congratulations on that. And thank you so much for telling your story. I know we got a little more personal, maybe a little bit more than you used to, but I really appreciate that. And I look forward to having you back on the show whenever you do write a book. We'll have to have you come annually because your books are great. And I enjoy, talking today very much. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Michael. It's been great being on with you.
That was Randy Gage, 14-time author, ex-juvenile delinquent, ex-failing restaurateur, and a super high-achieving long-shot leader. That guy has failed as much as he's won, but his victories are much bigger than his failures, and I love it. Thank you for joining us, and I look forward to hanging out with you all on the next episode. All right. If you want to find out more about our show, go to longshotleaders.com. If you want to be a part of something special and get your daily dose of inspiration, perspiration, exasperation, knowledge, and creativity, if you haven't done so already, subscribe to our podcast. And if you like what we do, share our show with your family and your friends, and put some positivity out there in the world. All right. Thank you for listening. And until we meet again on the next episode, I bid you adieu. Where did I get French from?
Hey, thanks for listening to the Power Prosperity Podcast. Do me a favor and practice the circulation law of prosperity and tell people about Prosperity TV. So if you would, just put something up on your Tumblr, your Twitter, your Facebook, your YouTube. Let people know what you think of the Power of Prosperity Podcast. Even take a screenshot of your phone and maybe post that picture so we can build the community here at the podcast. Thanks, guys.